After repair value, well, obviously by now you know you need to get a good realtor to help you determine what the true market value of the house is, both in its current condition and as well as in its after repaired condition. You need to take into account location within location. Even if it's in a great area, there are obviously better locations in good areas and there are worse locations in good area. Now, don't just use the averages. Now, let me just tell you guys a little bit of a story here. In hot markets, you can sell properties that are next, you know, that are in great neighborhoods, that are in next to railroad tracks, okay? You can typically do that pretty easily if the market's hot, meaning there's less than 6 months of inventory and it's a good area. In slow markets, when there's a lot of inventory, even in the good areas, it's going to be almost impossible to sell that house next to the railroad tracks unless you discount it significantly. So what does that mean if you have to discount it significantly? That means you have to make sure that the ARV value that you're using for your calculation to make your offer to the seller is consistent with what it will truly eventually sell for. So you do need to take into account not just location, but location within location, because otherwise in tough markets, it can certainly come back to bite you. Even in good markets, it's going to sell for less than what the other house that's not next to the railroad track is selling for. CMA value. Let's talk about the different ways to evaluate a property. There's obviously the as-is value, where you're looking at the current value of the property sold in its as-is condition with no repairs. Typically, your after repair value times 70% minus any repairs is the max that value that an investor is going to come up with the property, was going to come up with for the value of the property. However, if you're selling to a non-investor, if you're selling to a retail buyer, that price may be as high as, you know, the after repair value times 90% minus the repairs. Why is that? Why would a non-investor bite off an extra 20% and pay another 20% more than you would as an investor? Well, the answer sometimes is simple and sometimes it's sad. The case where it's simple is that, hey, they don't need to build in, you know, a 15% profit spread on a property because they're going to be staying there. They're going to be living there forever. It's their property. And a lot of times these, you know, retail buyers, they're going to be painting the house themselves. So they're going to save thousands and thousands of dollars. They're going to be doing a lot of work on the property themselves, you know, so they're going to save a lot of money. The sad situation comes into effect when the buyer doesn't know exactly how much it's actually going to take to repair the property and they're just overpaying for it. But don't always, you know, don't kick a deal out of bed until you've explored all the options for it. And sometimes even if you can't get the seller to do a 70% deal, sometimes you may have people who want to buy, you know, those 80 or 90% deals, minus repairs, obviously. And a lot of times those are number one, retail buyers, and number two, buy and hold investors who are just looking for, you know, a good enough deal to where if they had to sell it quickly, they wouldn't lose money on it. Buy and hold investors are buying and holding for the long term, and they will typically pay a little bit more because, again, they don't have to factor in their profit right up front. Now, after repair value, we've talked a lot about this, but let's just go ahead and take a second to review here. That's what the property will sell for if you did all the repairs that were needed on the property. Easy CMAs. We all love to do these CMAs because it doesn't take very much time and it doesn't take very much effort. Where can you get what property requires just an easy, quick CMA? Those are the bigger, newer neighborhoods built by the same builder in the last few years, and typically it's the homes that are less than 10 years old. If it's a big neighborhood, that means typically there's a lot of action over there. There are a lot of houses that are listed. There are a lot of houses that are selling. So typically for those neighborhoods, you need to include the following qualifiers. Obviously the subdivision that the neighborhood is in, and the size range. You want to make it between, you know, anywhere from 100 square feet to maybe 500 square feet, but maybe 300 is the average square feet in either direction. So if you have a 2,000 square foot house, you want to look at houses in the range of 1,700 square feet to 2,300 square feet to make sure that you get the a good estimate of the value there. And obviously you want houses with similar numbers of bedrooms and bathrooms. If your house is a, you know, two bedroom, one bath house, you probably don't want to, you know, compare it against a four bedroom, three bath house. More complex CMAs obviously get just a little bit tougher. And in a little bit older neighborhood, a house that's built before 1980, typically you'll need to include very similar qualifiers to some of the easier houses, the subdivision, the size range, the similar number of beds and baths. But if that's not giving you enough information to go on, because some of the older neighborhoods might be a little bit smaller, you can add some additional qualifiers. You can go a little bit broader and just look at the MLS area, but I would advise that that's probably a little bit too broad. You can look at a MAPSCO map grid page. So if you know, you can look at all the properties that are on MAPSCO page, you know, 500 or whatever map, you know, system that you guys use in your area. Or something that I do that I think more realtors should do is if it's in a very good elementary school district or a middle school district or high school district or whatever, do a search on the elementary school, because there can be a very large difference where I live, you know, even if a house is one block over, because it's not in a school district, an elementary school district that the buyer wants to be in, and that can affect the value by at least 10%, sometimes more. So do understand some of these factors as you're purchasing some of these investment properties. You know, elementary schools, you know, high schools, middle schools, these things matter to your buyers. So be sure to understand, especially if it's in an area where, you know, one side is a good one, one side is a bad one. And you may also need to make adjustments for different conditions of the property. You know, some houses that were built in 1980 or, you know, it's everything's brass. You know, other houses have been updated. They've been what we've called debrassified. And you might have, the oiled bronze or the brushed nickel, for example. So those will obviously sell a lot better. And then you also have the dated fixtures that you see in some of these homes of this vintage, which are, you know, the wall fixtures, the wallpaper. I've already talked about some of the brass fixtures. Sometimes the windows tend to go out or tend to fog. So these are just some of the items that you need to consider when you're doing CMAs in some of the older neighborhoods. Really complex CMAs. These are neighborhoods that were built more than 30 years ago. Now, again, you're going to see the same qualifiers as you did on the last two slides: subdivision, size range of the actual property itself. And if you're looking, if your exit strategy is actually to add more square footage to the actual property, you're going to look at some of the properties that are obviously a little bit larger to see what, instead of the 2,000 square foot homes are selling for, if you're going to add a 500 square foot addition, you want to know what the 2,500 square foot homes are selling for. Similar numbers of beds and baths, and that goes for your addition as well. And if it's in an area where you see a lot of change and a lot of new buildings coming in, even if in an old neighborhood, for example, you may want to consider the size of the lot, because sometimes the exit strategy for an investor can be doubling the square footage or, you know, tearing down the property that's there if it's not in good condition and building a condo building a duplex and then maybe condoing it out, or building a, you know, enormous McMansion, for example. Now, if that doesn't help you get enough information when you're valuing a property, you can also do the MLS area, use a MAPSCO page, use the elementary school, etc. Now, some areas get really tricky, and you just cannot use subdivision. There are parts of central Austin where the subdivisions are about two streets long, which has about zero value if you're trying to do a CMA on a particular subdivision in that neighborhood. So one of the things that us realtors have access to and check with your realtor is drawing tools, so they can actually draw a circle or a square, or they can draw a freaking octagon if they want to get to, you know, a specific area that they want to, you know, calculate the value on. And it may be, you know, that they want to see every house in such and such subdivision on this side of the railroad tracks, or on this side of the busy street, or on this side of the park, or just above the elementary school. So sometimes you can get very specific on some of these older homes. talk about some of the really complex CMAs that you can do. We have seen houses in areas where the average size of a particular property is 1,000, 1,500 square feet. So they're smaller homes, okay? Now, sometimes you'll see someone who will do a big addition and maybe build a 3,000 square foot home or even larger in that same neighborhood. And they may argue as the seller, well, the house across the street that's 1,500 square feet, well, that sold for $150,000. So my house has to be at least worth $300,000. Well, nope, I'm sorry, that's not the case. It's not always twice the value. On average, and these are just rough estimates that I use, and it may be different for your area, so do the due diligence and check. But what I've found is at most, a house that's twice the square footage is going to be as high as the highest price home that sold in the neighborhood, sometimes just a little bit more. But what I need to tell you about those houses is, you know, if you price them too high, what's going to happen is they're going to sit on the market a lot longer. If they're unusual homes, then they're going to sit on the market a lot longer because they're not the typical house that's being sold in that neighborhood. Now, the other big problem that you're going to have is if you try and go for, you know, let's say, you know, $195,000 on this house in a neighborhood where all the other homes don't sell for any more than $150,000, just as an example. Do you think your buyer's lender's appraiser is going to have a problem with that? The answer is yes. So that's why I say typically it's not going to be much more than the highest price home in the area. Now, what if you have a house that has a garage conversion? Again, in some areas, that's very typical. In newer home neighborhoods, you will not see garage conversions. But if you do, you've got to really lower the value of those because they're not common. People don't appreciate that. But if it is common in an area, let's say, you know, going back to the example that I used before, all the houses are 1,000 or 1,500 square feet and people need more room so they convert their garage so they can have that extra space. So if it's common, what I typically say is it's use the value or use the square footage of the main house times the average dollar per square foot in the neighborhood, and then use the conversion at about half of the dollar per square footage per square foot in the neighborhood if it's a good conversion. So let's say you have a 1,000 square foot house, and that's going for $100 a square foot. And then they converted their one car garage, let's say it was a 300 square foot garage. Instead of saying, you know, that's worth, you know, $30,000, no, instead only give it $15,000. So that house price would be $115,000. And again, that's assuming it's a good conversion. If it's in an area that's not common, you know, at worst, you can value it for less than zero. So what does that mean? That means basically if you have to rip down all of the stuff that they did in that garage to turn it back into a garage, whether it's, you know, removing some construction or whatever that was put in there, that's when it would be worth less than zero. On some of those homes, if it's a really good conversion, you might be able to add a couple thousand, maybe 10,000. And again, your mileage will vary. I'm talking about a house that's really priced in the, you know, $100,000 to $250,000 range. But again, it just depends on your particular area. As you get into more and more complex properties, again, we're going to continue on this theme. Let's talk about a house with a pool. If it's uncommon to the area, at best, the pool's probably worth nothing. If it's uncommon to the area, you know, at worst, the pool could be worth negative $5,000. Why do I say negative $5,000? Well, that's the cost it's going to take, or that's the amount it's going to take for you to, you know, jackhammer up the bottom of the pool, jackhammer up the sides, and fill it in with dirt, and then put grass on it and call it a day. If a pool is common to an area, sometimes you can add up to the 50% of the cost of the pool, assuming that it's in good condition. But do be aware that, you know, if you're buying something for buy and hold, you don't want your rental property to have a pool. If you're buying a fix and flip, and, you know, I'll say that most of the time you do not want the house to have a pool unless it's a really high-end house and every other house in the neighborhood has one. Now, if your house is next to something undesirable like a railroad track or an apartment complex or commercial buildings or busy streets, etc., you know, you will have a difficult time with these properties. What I tell people is that, you know, what you're going to see is the house is going to stay on the market about twice as long as the average home in the neighborhood. In addition, it's going to sell for about a 10 to 20% discount below what the average house in the neighborhood sells for, an average house that's not next to that problem area. So what I tell people, and we talked about this a little bit earlier about location within location, is be sure to compare houses to other properties with the same issues or on the same side of the street, if there are railroad tracks, for example, as your subject property. So if you have an odd, if your address is 1901 and your address backs to the railroad tracks, you're not going to want to use 1902 as your comp, and not as a good comp. You want to use 1903, 1905, 1907, etc. You want to use all the houses that actually back up to that side of the street because you want to get a fair analysis. Now, sometimes when you do that, you're going to be going back into different market cycles. Now, don't go so far back that you go into a market cycle that's not the market cycle that you're in. So, for example, if you're at the bottom of your market cycle, you only really want to look at, you know, sales that are recent and close to the bottom of the market cycle. If you're at the top of the market cycle, you want to look at houses that are also sold in the top of the market cycle, because if you go back too far, it's just not going to work. We've got a couple more slides about this sort of stuff coming up. More complex scenarios on CMAs. Let's talk about some tenant scenarios, because this is really important. When an area that is mostly homeowner occupied is occupied by the tenant, a tenant, and the house is put on the market, if the tenants are living at the property while you're trying to sell it, in most cases the value will go down by 10 to 15%. I have seen it myself. I have talked to many of my other colleagues about it. It is true. So strap in for that if that's what you're trying to do. And typically the house will stay on the market about twice as long as a property that's not tenant occupied. Now, why are these things universal truths? The reason why they're universal truths is because for whatever reason, tenants think that their properties and everything, all their possessions in it, are gold plated. And they do not want anybody to get into their property for fear that someone might steal something from them. It's crazy. If you think about a buyer in today's market that wants to sell a property, they will practically, you know, leave out a gold watch for the buyer to take if the buyer's going to actually make an offer on the property, right? They will do anything that they can to get a buyer into the property, versus a tenant will say, I'll be really flexible with you in showing the property. You can show it anytime between 2 p.m. and 5 p.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Hope that works for you. I hope you can see I'm being so flexible about it. So number one, tenants won't let people into the property and, you know, on the schedule that the buyers want to come and see the property. What do agents do? You know, good agents going to call the day before to set up an appointment with the tenant to see it. But some agents are getting calls and running to see the property like an hour after their client says, I want to see this property. So sometimes you're only going to get 1 hour's notice and the tenant's going to say no, versus a regular seller who's trying to desperately sell their property is going to say, yeah, just give me a couple extra minutes and I'm going to fix it up the best that I can. So they typically won't show the property, or they'll make it inconvenient for the buyer to see the property. And then the other thing is they're not like saying, ooh, I better make my bed today just in case, you know, someone comes to see the property, or ooh, I better clean up the house just in case someone sees the property. They don't have that same level of connection to, you know, the sales price and appreciation for that as a regular seller does. So that's why that happens. If the area is mostly tenant occupied, these are a little bit different scenarios, so pay attention to some of these. If it's occupied and there are many months on the lease, and basically, you know, the only buyer for the property is going to be an investor buyer, gosh, I'd get pretty excited about that and think, oh, good, I don't have to do anything for a while because, you know, I've got a tenant in there and they must be happy because they're saying. So it'll probably sell at market value within the average days on market for an area that has a lot of other tenant-occupied properties, an area that's primarily purchased by other landlords. Now, if the occupied property just has, if the tenant just has a couple months left on the lease, it might sell at market value within the average days on market. But what you might also find is that a buyer, for example, I as an investor, would insist that the tenant sign a new lease so they don't have to spend money to fix up the property and re-rent it, because we know as investors and landlords that your most expensive time of being a landlord is when you're actually trying to, you know, fix the property up to get it re-leased, so you're off the market during that time, and then you're waiting to find your tenant to lease it to. So that can be typically very expensive. So those are some advanced scenarios on doing CMAs on tenant-occupied properties. Triangulating on value. Now, we've discussed many, many ways to come up with the after repair value on a property. We've talked about tax appraised values. We've talked about professional appraised values. We've talked about using realtors. We've talked about some of the scenarios of valuing some of the complex properties. Now, what I typically say is, you know, analyze the property using multiple tools. You know, you might discover something new, you know, once you add in, you know, the not just the subdivision, but the school district. So look at the subdivision, look at the school district, look at the maps code grid, draw a map, you know, try and really spend some time to figure this thing out, and that may clue you in into, you know, some values that you're really excited about, or maybe some values that you're not really excited about, but it will help you make your ultimate decision on what to offer for that property based on what you think you're actually going to resell it for. Now, if you are not a realtor, please get a realtor. Please ask a realtor. They'll typically evaluate the property for free, or they'll do it for a minimal fee, or they'll say, hey, I'll help you if you give me the listing after you finally get one of these. You know, realtors, they need to be on your power team. They are important in helping you, you know, make some of these ultimate decisions on, obviously, this section has talked about houses with equity, but it is important, again, you know, even if you're dealing with houses without equity, which is what the mortgage assignment program is about, you definitely need to have a realtor on your power team. Coming up with your final list price or resale value, I want to give you guys some pricing tips that you're going to be able to use on any property that you work with in the future. So here you go. If you're considering pricing a property at $195,000, you might as well start at $200,000. And if you're considering pricing at $147,000, well, you should probably go ahead and adjust that upwards to $150,000. Now, why is that? Now, for you guys out there, when you were looking for purchasing your home, you never told your realtor, hey, I can go as high as $194,350. No, you said I can go as high as $195,000 or as high as $200,000 or as high as $150,000. Now, most buyers get qualified up to round numbers like $200,000 or $150,000. So if they're looking at a property that's $147,000 and it's in the same neighborhood that's with a property that's $150,000, guess what? They're going to look at both. Now, some buyers may also have their search criteria, you know, from $175,000 to $200,000, and other buyers will have their search criteria from $200,000 to $225,000. So if you price it at $199,900 or even, you know, $195,000, you might miss some of those buyers that would have otherwise looked at your property on the high end. But if you price it at $200,000, you'll get both the $175,000 to $200,000 buyers as well as the $200,000 to $225,000 buyers to actually look at your property, which is good because, you know, more people in means more potential, you know, offers. Now, you might get lucky and you might actually sell the house right away, and you don't want to leave any money on the table, and that's another reason why you should go with this strategy. But my advice to you guys is that if you don't get a quick sale, meaning a sale within, you know, about a week or two, you should quickly lower the price down to your real after repair value or real list price number. Now, the other important note that you guys need to consider is, while this is a great strategy for listing your house after you finish it up and do all your remodeling work, Do not use this strategy during your negotiation with the seller, with the prior owner, when you're purchasing the property. Instead, use the true after repair value. If it's $195, use $195. If it's $147, then use $147. And then that's the number that you're going to use your maximum allowable offer formula on, which again is the ARV at, for example, $147 times 70% minus the repairs. So just a couple of tips for you to wrap up this section. How do you evaluate properties in different market conditions? This is really an important slide for you guys to sort of ponder over when you're looking more specifically at equity deals. But what I wanted to tell you is, in a good market, if the market is moving upward, then your selling after repair value or your final list price may be higher than you originally thought. You know, some areas it may be going up, you know, by 10% if you end up holding it for several months, for example. But in a bad market, if the market's, you know, going down, then you may actually end up reducing your ARV or reducing your list price by as much as 10%. Now, a lot of this will also depend on how long you're actually holding the property. If the days on market are increasing in the area that you're looking at, you're actually going to want to pay less, and vice versa. You know, there's kind of a couple of funny little, you know, things about being a real estate investor. It's always either easy to buy and hard to sell, or hard to buy and easy to sell. So when is it easy to buy and hard to sell? It's easy to buy and hard to sell when the market is a down market. So you've got, you know, maybe not as many people competing for the same property as you, but you also have not as many buyers competing to buy your finished product. And a lot of times when it's harder to buy and easier to sell, well, that's when you're in an up market and the market's, you know, shooting upwards, where it's hard because there's so much competition from investors, you know, on the front end, you actually may end up paying a little bit more, but on the back end, it'll be easy to sell because you have more, obviously, and buyers competing as well. Now, in different markets, we're more or less willing to take on different types of properties. So in a market where there's, you know, 2 years of inventory of $1 million plus homes, we're not going to be really excited about taking on a, you know, $1 million property, because the holding costs is something that will kill you as a real estate investor. If we're in a market like that, then we want to get in and we want to get out as quickly as possible. If the market's starting to go, you know, if the market's going down and holding time's going to go down, we want to get in properties where the holding time, where the months of inventory is really short, because there's nothing like being in a market where the months of inventory are increasing right when you're starting a major project. So we typically don't start major projects, like, you know, 6 month, 1 year projects, when the market is going down. But we will start those kind of projects when the market is going up, meaning when the, you know, after repair or final list price that you have sometimes can increase by 10%. That's when the market can carry you upward. But, you know, the market can just as easily carry you downward. If you're bouncing around along the bottom of a down market, then it depends on how much cash you have on hand. At the end of a down market, the best thing to do is to start some of these, you know, bigger dollar projects. But sometimes, you know, because you're cautious, you know, you're not a gambler, you're an investor, you're going to hold off a little bit of while to see if you're actually, you know, going to get out of the down market and recover. Every market has its cycles, and we're actually going to go through sort of a simple market cycle example on the next slide. But you do need to understand that, you know, as your market changes, you're going to implement different strategies. You know, mortgage assignment is perfect for today's market. Why? Because we've got a lot of low interest rate loans sitting around there, and we've got a lot of buyers that can't get loans, but we still have a lot of sellers that still need to sell. So in this type of a market, you know, if you're a student of the market like we are, you're going to be studying and you're going to find that mortgage assignments are the way to go right now. But we're going to go through a couple more examples on the next slide. Where are we in today's market cycle? And what's your strategy in today's market cycle? This little drawing here that we put out here for you is a very simple little drawing, and you can actually look at this and draw 50 of them and string them all together, and that is a typical market cycle. Now, you'll notice on this market cycle, the up cycle is actually twice as long as the down cycle, meaning you fall really fast, but you go up at kind of a slow, organized pace. So an up cycle may be a, 2 to 5 year cycle, whereas a down cycle is typically a, 1 to 2.5 year cycle. It happens very quickly. It feels like someone's pulled the rug out from underneath you very quickly. The other thing that you need to note, and I've got a little notation here for you, is that sellers are always 6 months behind what the market is actually at, where the market actually is. So when the market is at its very top, they think it's, got some ways to go. When the market starts to turn down, the sellers still think that the market is at their top. Why? Because they're still pulling open house, they're still going to open houses, they're still pulling flyers out of their neighbors' yards. They think that the market is still moving upward. They don't know what the houses are really selling for. It's not until after they've seen some of the things go on in their neighborhood for at least 6 months before they're actually able to catch up. Now, that works against you when the market is going down until a certain point when the sellers all realize, oh crap, all of our house values are down and we're not going to do as well as we thought we were on some of these, on a property that they have. So when they get to that point, we call it the point of capitulation. And we as real estate investors, we love that point because that's when we're typically going to get the best deals. And that's typically sort of around the bottom of the market. And again, as you're going up on the other side of the market, as the market's increasing, it's actually a great thing that they're 6 months behind because then they think it's worth less than what you know it's worth. So it's always a very interesting cycle. And then what we talk about when we talk about strategies is, we're introducing a couple of different strategies to you guys using the mortgage assignment program. We also have our Revolution program, which goes through, over 12 different strategies, not just mortgage assignment, but 12 different strategies to show you how to do deals in the different market conditions that you're going to be looking at and what's the best things to put into play in all those different market conditions. Now, as we said in the last slide, I'm not going to take on a, 6 to 12 month project when the market's going down, but I will take on one when the market's going up. So you just have to be a student of the market. You have to, be creative when the market changes. That's why the MAP strategy is so critical and so important and so useful in today's market. So just be aware, study where you're at, and make those decisions accordingly.